welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 23rd of January, 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week. It's actually a glorious sunny day here, a glorious sunny winter's day, and we're here today to talk about the news that is of interest to British nationalists, and we actually have a Greatest Britain that we're going to get into today as well, which will be Oswald Mosley. And who better to discuss the week's news with than my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How is life treating you?
Yeah, life's treating me okay. I'm looking forward to today's discussion. We've got a couple of interesting subjects here to enlighten our listeners about, and it should be a good show today.
Excellent. And I really wanted to begin with this shocking news story about a police officer in the Metropolitan Police who has basically admitted raping and sexually assaulting a dozen women over nearly two decades. And this wasn't women that he had arrested or anything like that. It was women in his private life. It was girlfriends of his. So this is probably the reason why it was allowed to go on. But there's been a huge uproar about this. And lots of people have been saying that the police can't be trusted. They've been saying that we need to have more women in the police, as if this is going to stop this sort of thing from happening. And they've also been referring this Sarah Everard story from earlier on in the year, when this poor woman was raped and murdered by a police officer who had been acting crazy before then. He'd been exposing himself in McDonald's, all sorts of things like this. And it's basically making the police look really bad. But you have to put it into perspective. You have to actually look at the number of these sorts of things that goes on. And I have a quote here. There were 160,000 police officers in the UK in 2020. One of them was a murderer. One of them was a rapist. And that's 0.00125% of the workforce. So you have to put it into perspective. But in the same way, you also have to look at what's going on here. Why is it that we have these police officers that are turning out to be bad eggs? And is there going to be more of that happening in the future because of the lowering of standards that is going on in order to fulfill diversity quotas? Because you have this big drive to get black and minority ethnics into the police, and one of the ways that they're doing that is they're lowering the requirements. It used to be that if you had a criminal record, you couldn't get into the police. But now they are saying if you have a criminal record, you can still be a police officer, because such a high number of black and minority ethnic people, unfortunately, have criminal records. And I've got a quote here I think he's a serving police officer. He's anonymous. He says, "I'm looking at an article which shouts from the rooftops about the proportion of black and minority ethnic recruits being successfully enrolled. And here I even see a mention of blue sky thinking. Numbers and percentages are declared like Soviet tractor production figures, though they're reticent to publish the consequent disciplinary and misconduct statistics due to the lack of diligence in the vetting process. Such is the rush to make the force more reflective that some individuals who should be nowhere near a police uniform or the attendant responsibilities find themselves with a whole load of power. Not only is this dangerous, but it also means yet further possible negative publicity, as if we needed that right now. It is also more than a little patronising to the communities which the police purport to serve, as well as the officers in question, who know exactly why they have been chosen, yet again, to stand in front of a camera. But rest assured, as an organisation, we are now looking at the disproportionate negative outcomes for those officers from underrepresented communities who fall foul of the disciplinary process. So if an inadequately vetted officer crosses a disciplinary or criminal line, it could still be down to some vague institutional ism. Strolling a little bit further, we get to gender identity. No issue in wider society seems to be further removed from reality than this, with some willing to turn biology on its head in order to come across as worthy. The police want to be on the right side of history, so they subscribe to a good deal of this stuff, so much so that they employ the Progress Pride flag, the one with the BLM, and trans incisions, where the old gay pride colours are becoming more obscured with each iteration. It even has the intersex circle upon it, so we can demonstrate that an infinitesimally small number of people are also in our thoughts. We're nothing if not current. Some issues immediately jump out here. First, has anyone of seniority or their advisors actually looked at Black Lives Matter's website? This august group is apparently working for a world where black lives are no longer systematically targeted for demise. Does UK policing really want to be associating itself with that sort of ridiculous and provocative language? It seems, as with many things, that this is a passing bandwagon which cannot be allowed to drive past without senior officers Fosbury flopping onto it. And it's quite a long article, but people will be able to find that at the conservativewoman.co.uk inside our Woker Than Woke Police. And he's raising serious points here, that the police are now more concerned with all these left-wing progressive ideologies than they are with actual policing. I think there's something like less than 5% of burglaries actually now result in somebody being prosecuted for them. We talked last year, I think, about the police. They actually had a routine of only going to the odd numbers if they reported a burglary in one street, and only going to the even numbers if they reported to a burglary in another street. And yet we have all this concentration that is going on, so-called hate crimes online, and we have all this push to get more black and minority ethnics into the police. And now, after this David Carrick has carried out all these rapes, there are all these calls to say that we need to have more women in the police. We need to have 50% women in the police because the population is 50% women. Which, of course, is rather ridiculous. Why don't we have people in the police that are qualified to be there? You want somebody strong, for a start. They used to say that they had to be 6 foot tall. We want somebody that is capable of preventing crimes, arresting people. Women are not capable of arresting people in the middle of a crime, are they? They're likely to be overpowered. I've seen so many videos of women police officers that are just being laughed at, basically, by the people that they're trying to arrest, people managing to escape from the police. And now, instead of people actually helping out when somebody is trying to escape from police, if you're in London, you're more likely to have a crowd of people filming it on their phones, trying to help the people that the police are trying to arrest. And the people that the police are usually trying to arrest in London are the people that the police force are bending over backwards to get to join the police. By that, I mean from the same ethnic group are most likely the ones that they're trying to get in the police. And then you've got all this problem with knife crime that is there. And every time the police try to do something about this, they get accused of racial profiling. And of course, you are going to get more black people that are stop and searched for knives because statistically black people are more likely to be involved in knife crime. So either you are going to have to be racially profiled or there's going to be more knife crime. And the way to solve this isn't to get more black and minority ethnic into the police. They've been trying to do this for a long time now. And all that's happened is that there's been an increase in knife crime. So I think people's trust in the police is at an all-time low, Max. And I mean, you're a bit older than I am, and you remember the police, obviously, and the police TV programs from some time back. And you were saying that some of this may tie in with the changes of perception with the police programs that we see. And just before I pass it over to you, I'll also say that, you know, when I was young, you would see the police, you would still see them on bicycles. And I can remember living in a rural area and going from a rural area back to an area that had cities in it after about 4 or 5 years, and being really shocked to suddenly see that the police were all wearing these stab vests and they had all these weapons on show. And it looked like they, you know, that they were really spoiling for a fight, basically. And I can remember thinking, when did this happen? When did the police become all militarized like this? And as I say, I can remember them being on bicycles when I was a youngster. But what are your thoughts on all this, Max, and this scandal with this police officer that's been accused of all these rapes, admitted to all these rapes?
Yeah, I haven't got a lot to say about the police officer that's admitted to these rapes, but going back to one of the things that you've mentioned, that there has been an assault on the reputation and the regard with which the police are held by the general public. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that that's the case. I'm old enough to remember the early post-Second World War years here in the UK, and my very first sort of impressions of police officers were that they were always very smartly dressed. They used to wear a tunic, they used to have those tall helmets, with a strap under their chin. Always wore a collar and tie, and they always had shoes or boots polished in the same sort of way that that the military do. And a large number of the police officers in those early post-war years were actually ex-servicemen who took military standards of dress, etc., and maintained those in the police force. So they were always very smartly dressed. They were always, as well, larger than average people. And I know that there was a minimum standard for police officers in terms of height, which was 5'8", that prevailed over a large part of the country right up until the sort of 70s and the 80s. Some police forces also had an even higher minimum height of 6 foot. And I think as far as the City of London Police Force, if my memory serves me correctly, up until the 70s, I think they had a minimum height of 6'2", so that they were even taller. And so with the helmets that they used to have, the very tall helmets, it made them look like they were 8 feet high. And typically, a policeman in those days was probably 15 stone or something like that, and not 15 stone of big wobbly belly, but 15 stone of fairly hard muscle. And I can remember as a child, as the years passed, you didn't mess with the police in those days because they were just so much bigger and so much stronger than the average person. And crime was very much lower in those days. But what's tended to happen is that we've had a number of effects. So slowly, the sort of left-wing ideology or woke ideology has seeped its way into the upper echelons of the police force and started to have an effect on recruitment. So that the police can recruit more people from ethnic minorities and can recruit more women into the police force. They've reduced the height limit and now completely abolished it. So there are police officers being recruited who are only 5 foot tall. And, people will argue that, as long as a police officer can defend themselves and look after themselves in a fight, then it doesn't really matter how tall they are. But the point of the matter is that if you are presented with somebody who's got a tall helmet on, who appears to be immaculate, and so the effect of having an immaculate tunic with a big helmet on the top and a big person and a big man underneath it, first of all, is that it has the Darth Vader effect of making you think, by heck, I'm not going to mess with this person. Whereas if you're a criminal and you're confronted by a police officer who's 5 foot tall, the chance that you will try and use violence in order to evade that police officer is far higher than the chance that you try and use violence to evade the police officers of old. But in addition to the woke agenda that's been pushed over recent decades, we've also had, as I say, this assault on the integrity of the police force, which has come about as a result of various TV programs. And so I can remember from my sort of early youth police programs like Dixon of Dock Green, where the police were always portrayed as being the good guys, and where they had a beat that they used to follow. They weren't just driving round in cars in areas of the country that they didn't know. They had a beat that they walked. Usually, I think it was like twice a day they would walk their beat, and they would get to know all the people that lived in all the houses in the area that they covered. They would know that at certain times of day, a gate in a certain yard would be left open, and at other times of day, that gate would be closed. And so if they passed it and noticed that the door was open or been forced open at a time when it was shouldn't have been open, then they would intervene and they would investigate that. And they used to catch lots of people who were committing crimes. And as I say, crime was much lower in those days as a result of the fact that it was quite likely that you'd be caught. And if you were confronted by a police officer, there wasn't very much point in trying to resist. But what's happened is that there was then a program that came out, a TV program called Z Cars. And this was this came out at the time that there was a great drive to reduce the number of police officers in order to make cutbacks in government expenditure, and by putting police officers in cars so that they could drive around a much, much larger beat, this was thought to be the way to tackle crime. The police could therefore be much more visible than they would be if they were just walking around. But the upshot of it was that police officers then found themselves with these much larger beats that they didn't know properly. They couldn't possibly get on intimate nodding terms with all the people that lived in these enormous beats. And so they would drive around in their cars, because they were in cars, particularly if it was a wet day where the rain would be running down the windows of their car. As they looked out, they couldn't really see very much, so they wouldn't spot if somebody had forced a door open or something of that sort. And so crime started to increase as a result of the effect of this. And the police, because they were driving around in cars, didn't tend to have face-to-face meetings with members of the public, because prior to that, police officers would either be walking or they'd be riding a bicycle, or when they passed you in the street, they would nod and say hello, and sometimes they would just stop and have a chat with you just because you were somebody new that they didn't know, and they wanted to get to know you so that they could so that you would be familiar with them and they would be familiar with you. But it wasn't until probably the 70s with programs like the Sweeney, which then tended to show instances of police officers being corrupt. This then continued with two recent TV series that are actually quite entertaining TV programs, but nonetheless they do depict a very sad state of affairs for the police force. Happy Valley and a Line of Duty, particularly. With Line of Duty, virtually an entire police force is portrayed as being corrupt to its absolute core, and so what's happened is that this has tended to erode the public's perception of the police. And so instead of assuming that the police are honest people and good people, and as a child I can remember my mother saying to me, if you ever get lost and you don't know where you are, always find a policeman and ask them if they can show you the way home, and that would be the safe thing to do. Nowadays, belief in the innate goodness of the police force has now been sort of completely eroded away. And in over the last sort of few days, we've had statements made by, generally speaking, Black Lives Matter kind of groups that campaign against any form of assertive policing in high immigrant areas, claiming that because of this chap who apparently raped a number of women, etc., that single male police officers should no longer be allowed to walk the streets and intervene and approach people. They should only be allowed to walk the streets if they've got a female colleague with them to make sure that they don't rape anybody whilst they're out on the streets. And as you said, although there've been these two cases recently, these two cases have been spoken about in the press, and the voice of woke organizations has been magnified to the point now where members of the public could be forgiven for thinking that the police force, that the entire country is entirely riddled with corruption, which I'm sure is not the case. In addition to the media making that assault on the police, and it's not just the police that get this as well, it's programs that deal with the security services, MI5. Programs are made in America about American society that deal with American police officers. They're always shown as being corrupt. The FBI is always shown as being corrupt. The CIA is always shown as being corrupt. So all organizations that are intended to enforce law and order are constantly being shown as corrupt in film after film after film, in TV program after TV program after TV program. And on top of that, you've got various instances. I can remember some years back now, I can't remember exactly when it was, I think it was the early 70s, there was the riot in Red Lion Square because the National Front were having a march through London, and there was a riot in Red Lion Square where a great horde of left-wing activists were rioting, and the police were sent in order to try and restore law and order. And a person, whose name I think was Kevin Blakelock, was hit on the head by a police officer with a truncheon, and he died as a result of that. And so there was a great inquiry into this. Lord Scarman's inquiry. And Lord Scarman's inquiry established that the police weren't institutionally racist. That was what he said, I believe. But he then went on to say, though, that race relations and relations between the police and the ethnic minority communities would be greatly improved if there was more positive discrimination in favour of ethnic minorities. And that then was followed by the McPherson report into the murder of Stephen Lawrence, which then where the police were labelled as being institutionally racist. And from that point onwards, the police have effectively been on their knees in front of the media, and have just been constantly castigated. And every time there's any incident which could possibly arouse the memory of Stephen Lawrence or the Scarman inquiry, again, all these things are churned up. And again, it gives the impression that the police are absolutely riddled with hateful people who just want to abuse black people, and are full of people who are corrupt in lots of other respects. And what we've got is a situation where the qualifications and the selection process where people want to join the police force has been slowly relaxed, and I'm sure this is one of the things that is responsible for the police of themselves becoming increasingly demoralized, because not only are they suffering a savaging of their reputation by the media, they're suffering a savaging of their reputation by the the courts when these inquiries and things are held, and they're increasingly in a situation where they're being encouraged to recruit people, women and ethnic minorities, in situations where which can only make policing generally more difficult. It's one thing to say that women are 50% of the population, so therefore 50% of the police should be women, 50% of the police should be men. But if something like 90% of all violent crime is committed by men, and only a very small proportion of violent crime is committed by women, then it would be appropriate then to have a larger proportion of police officers that are men, so that they've got the strength to oppose the people who might be committing violent crime, rather than having 50% of them women, where you're then requiring women to go into situations where they will then be required to confront men, and in some cases confront men that are much, much larger and much more muscular and heavily built and violent than they are. And I think that's something which puts lots of women police officers at great risk. And as I say, especially if they're only 5 foot tall or just marginally higher than 5 foot tall, and they are facing up to criminals who are large and heavily built. And it's a great shame, really, because as I say, I mean, as a child, I lived through a time when the police were trusted, and the police were regarded as a force because they enforced the law, and where the police lived in police houses within the communities that they served. So they not only had a small beat that they learnt to that they learnt about intimately, so that they knew everything that was going on in their beat. So if anything was going wrong, they could intervene sometimes even before the crime had been committed, they could intervene, and they lived in houses within that beat, and they were so they identified so closely, and the people who lived on their beat identified so closely with the police officers that the police officers and their families were safe living in the on the beat where the officer patrolled. Whereas nowadays, police officers wouldn't dream of living in the area where that they actually police, because it would put their family at risk, because criminals would learn where they lived, and criminals would then threaten them and threaten to harm their families. And so the police have progressively become alienated, especially by, as I say, the other factor again, which is driving around in cars instead of walking the beat or cycling. And you can go nowadays for many days on end and never see a police officer. You know, if you go down to your local town centre and you walk through the town centre, occasionally you might see a police officer, but quite often you won't see one. And you can go into town and come home, and then the following day you can go into town and come home and still not see a police officer. And day after day after day can go by, and the police officers themselves, the police forces, or the police services as they're now called, the police services struggling to recruit policemen, because people realise that they are quite often, even if they're a man, are going to be sent into a situation where they're going to have to confront several criminals, most of which are going to be men if they're violent criminals, and all they're going to have to back them up is, in some cases, a woman who, for no fault of her own, is only 5 foot tall, and that can't be a very inspiring prospect.
And I think they know that if race is involved in this, somebody is arrested, say, and they fight back, and the police officer ends up killing them, then they know that there's going to be another inquiry. They're going to be accused of a racist murder. Black Lives Matter are going to be involved. And so they may not want to get involved in it in the first place. And I think when you bring up the point of these police houses, that's a very good example of the way that it's changed. I mean, they used to live in these police houses. Everybody knew where the police officers lived, because there was no risk to the police officers. They were seen as a very positive influence in the community. And yet today, of course, they can't live in the police houses because they would be at risk. And you mentioned this chap that was ended up being killed there, and I think maybe I got that mixed up with PC Keith Blakelock, because he was the police officer that was murdered.
I got the name wrong. Actually, it wasn't Kevin Blakelock, it was Kevin Gately. That's right. It's just my memory has just clicked back in there.
Yeah, but again, these riots that were going on at the time that this Scarman report was a part of, it was these same riots where this PC Keith Blakelock ended up being beheaded. So you end up with a black person that gets killed. You end up with a white police officer that gets killed. They have an investigation into this, and then they decide that the police are institutionally racist. But they didn't look at the actual statistics and look at the statistics and say, right, well, it does appear as if this one ethnic group commit more crime when compared to other ethnic groups. And they refuse to do that, yet they will do that when they look at crimes carried out between men and crimes carried out between women. And they will say, well, men commit more crimes than women. That's just a fact there. They don't say that police officers are using gender profiling when they're questioning men about a crime, yet they will say that it's racial profiling when police will stop and search somebody because they're black. And the reason they've done that is because somebody's given a witness statement that somebody who is black is obviously linked together with some particular crime. Yet if those numbers of the people that they're stopping and searching outnumber their percentage of the population, then the police officer is at risk of being accused of racism and racial profiling. So we've got all these problems that are associated with it. And I think a lot of the police don't want to be police anymore. We see a lot of people that are resigning, a lot of disaffection between the police, as I pointed out in this article that we started off this discussion about. This is a police officer that is very concerned about this. And there have been quite a few that have said about this. I think there was the new police chief in Manchester the new police chief of the Metropolitan. I think he's spoken up about this and how this political correctness is now seen as being more important than anything else. And this idea that the police have to reflect the people that are actually being policed, I mean, that's rather like saying that children should be taught by children, isn't it? I mean, surely you want to be policed by people that have the physical strength, that have the intelligence, that have the emotional intelligence. These are the things that you want to see within the police. And of course, they want to be taught that not to racially profile people, to take people as individuals. But at the same time, they should be taking notice of statistics and which group is most likely to be carrying out these crimes. But they need to be emotionally intelligent enough to judge an individual, look at an individual and say whether he is likely to be carrying out, whether he's likely to be a criminal or not. And I think most of the police are capable of doing this, but they just get accused of racism when they use their common sense with these stop and search laws. I mean, I guess one way around this would be to say, well, just end up with black police policing the black community. And again, that goes back to ethnic separatism, which is the way that things should be. And then they wouldn't be able to accuse the police of there being discriminating against them, because all the police that were dealing with them would be of the same ethnicity. And I think another thing that plays into this is the promotion in the mainstream media that the police are all racist as well. So then you end up with somebody who is black and the police are asking them questions or whatever, and the black person panics because he thinks that the police are out to get them. So he panics and then he resists arrest, and then he can end up getting hurt by the police. And I think that happens a lot of the time. We know this happens in America, but we see the same thing happening in Britain. I think it was one of these Labour MPs was in a car, and she was filming the police and saying that she was worried because she was black and the police might hurt the people in the car. All this sort of thing. So, and the mainstream media encouraged this belief amongst the black community that the police are out to get them. So, I mean, all of these things, they're all problems that are caused by the policy of multiculturalism. If we didn't have this policy, you would have black people that are being policed by black policemen, and you'd have white people that were being policed by white policemen. You still have the different crime rate that you get amongst the black community as you do amongst the white community. But this element of racism would not exist. It wouldn't be possible for the element of racism to exist there. I mean, that is the solution to all of this, not encouraging the police force to be even more multicultural. You know, how is that going to solve the problems? It isn't going to solve the problems to have people employed by the police that aren't there for their qualifications, but are just there because of their ethnic characteristics or their sexuality characteristics or their gender characteristics. I mean, what people want is people to be employed on their merit, and they want police officers that are good at their job. I think that's more important. And I think the mother of a black child who's been stabbed would say she would rather that the police did search black suspects than didn't search black suspects. And I should imagine that a black mother of a son who's been stabbed and have lost their son would say it's more important to have police officers that are good at their job rather than police officers that are not going to go anywhere near the black community because they might be accused of discrimination. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, well, I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying there. I just want to just wanted to apologise to the family friends of Keith Blakelock, who was the police officer that was murdered on the Broadwater Farm riots that occurred during the 1980s. Because I mistook his name. It was a mistake on my part. I'd relied too heavily on my memory rather than double checking the figures. And we earlier on made it appear that he was somebody who's involved in the Red Lion Square riots, which wasn't the case. He was a very brave police officer who gave his life in those ghastly riots on the Broadwater Farm estate in London. But I think that what we've been talking about here is a process of sort of progressive diversity that's been that can be seen in lots of other aspects of our society. And the thing that we find is that where multiculturalism and multiracialism expand, so Lawlessness also expands, and all forms of social dysfunction expand proportionately. And what happens though is that where we have an elite within this country who are very woke and who don't have the best interests of the indigenous British people at heart, is that the their answer, as you indicated, Sven, their answer to every problem that comes up as a result of their programs to expand and increase diversity is to slap a whole load of more diversity on top. So you end up with a situation of cumulative toxic diversity, and that's the direction we're going in at the moment. But hopefully in the years to come, we'll be able to turn the tide and return to rationality.
Well, more people certainly seem to be waking up to what's going on and the problems that are caused by multiculturalism. Shall we move into our greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, I think that would be a good idea.
Yes, let's talk about one of our greatest Britons who did actually try to, who could actually see the dangers that were going to happen in the future with multiculturalism and tried to put a stop to it, a greatest Briton that almost actually became Prime Minister, which I was amazed to discover. I never realised we had nationalists get that close to actually getting hold of power. And we are, of course, talking about Sir Oswald Ernold Moseley, who's actually also a sixth baronet, who was incredibly popular before the Second World War. And during the Second World War, him and his party, the British Union Fascists, they were arrested, they were put in prison, not against any charges at all. They had no habeas corpus, and we'll talk about what happened there as we get into this. But I think after that, the name that he had, the good name that he had, had been smeared, you know, because he'd been put in prison. And all the while, it was Neville Chamberlain that was Prime Minister. Even though the war had started, I think he was safe. But once Winston Churchill came into power, within 2 weeks, Oswald Mosley and all the British Union Fascists, they'd all been put in prison with no, as I say, with no habeas corpus and no charges against them. Now, I've heard of Oswald Mosley. I'd looked into him a bit, but I'd never been a huge fan of Oswald Mosley. It wasn't Oswald Mosley that brought me into nationalism. It was really looking at American stuff, looking at racial statistics, and then looking at revisionist history of the Second World War, and then coming across Oswald Mosley. And I did an interview with somebody in their 90s who was actually a part of Oswald Mosley's party after the Second World War, and he was around during the Second World War. We called him Mr. I, and people can find the interviews with him talking about this particular time period. We've got them on the Radio Albion site, and I believe round about he tried to do things after the Second World War. He tried to get this Europe a nation thing off the ground, and some people said that he was quite visionary as far as the European Union was concerned, but obviously on a different basis than the European Union is today. But I can't recall ever seeing him actually interviewed on the television. I don't think any of my family were big fans of Oswald Mosley or anything like that. But I do know Laura Towler is a huge fan of Oswald Mosley, and he does have a lot of support still within this country. And there was a huge movement of support behind him. Max, do you know? Do you recall seeing him on the television? Were you involved in nationalism at all whilst Oswald Mosley was still alive and active?
I don't have any direct recollections of him campaigning. I think that I was probably too young or perhaps not even born in the sort of early post-war years when he came back and launched it was a union movement that he launched, I believe, in 1948. And that continued to exist through to about 1973, which is where, as you say, he was trying to promote this idea of Europe a nation. And I think that he also was a member during part of that period of an organisation called the National Party of Europe, which is a kind of an international thing. And I know that he did write also for a magazine that was produced by the Italian nationalist organisation. I think the initials are MSI. during that sort of period as well. But it was Regulation 18B that resulted in Moseley being put in prison during the most of the Second World War. The only time I actually saw him speaking was in an interview, a television interview, and I can't remember who the interviewer was, but the interviewer appeared Weasley by comparison, and Oswald Mosley was spoke with great gravitas. I've seen films of him speaking as a younger man, and he was a very charismatic character, and was a great orator, and introduced a great element of drama into the speeches that he made. And you know, he wasn't somebody who just stood calmly at a lectern with his hands resting on the lectern, you know, perhaps occasionally flipping a page over. He appeared to have all of his speeches committed to memory, and he used a lot of dramatic hand gestures in order to emphasize his words, and there's a very famous piece of video of him speaking at one of the large meetings that he organized, I think at Olympia, where he is speaking at his best. But there are other examples of him speaking in various London locations, I think Limehouse was a place where there were quite a large number of Mosley supporters, and there was a very famous speech that I think he made at Limehouse at some point during the days of the British Union of Fascists. That was the organisation that he promoted between 1932 and 1940, before he was arrested under Regulation 18B.
Yeah, I think it's actually a great shame there aren't more recordings of him. I think that's one of the things we're actually lacking is enough recordings of Oswald Mosley speaking. We have lots of text format versions, but if you go looking online, you'll find that there's 2-minute clips of him, things like that. I think there's that one long speech that you're referring to, Max, but there's very little else. There was a very good video documentary that was brought out about him, I seem to recall, a year ago or 2 years back, an excellent video documentary. And obviously he's featured in historical films of the time, but they always try to portray him in a negative light. And we're actually getting our notes for this. We're getting our notes from Wikipedia. We're also including his own book, My Life, which is his own autobiography. And I've been checking the Wikipedia notes up against what he says in his book. And unsurprising, I guess you could say, the Wikipedia notes are wrong. Some of them have included an incident which is not mentioned at all in his book. I think if he doesn't talk about this and he says the opposite of what the Wikipedia notes are saying, then we have to go with what he is saying, because that's the original documentary source, isn't it, of the time. That was him writing about it. That was his memory. And that's what we should really be going with. But he's obviously still a big influence on today. I mentioned Laura Towler there. She's a big fan of Oswald Mosley. And there's even a resurgence, I think, of the British Union of Fascists. I think they're sort of more like, they like to dress up like it. And I think they're more like a live action role playing organization, but they do obviously support his politics. There's a very good website online, which might be maintained by them. I think I actually interviewed the chap that was behind this new British Union, but they're obviously not a large organisation, but they are included amongst the nationalist organisations within Britain. But the actual black shirts and the wearing of the black shirts, that was outlawed, and that same law was used against Britain First, I think, at some point. That's really my sort of recollections about him. Do you want to add anything to that, Max, before we get on with the overview of his life?
No, let's press on with the overview. Yeah, that should be there. Best way forward, I would think.
Okay, well, Sir Oswald Ernold Mosley, the 6th Baronet, was born on the 16th of November 1896, and he died on the 3rd of December 1980, so he had a nice long life there. He was a British politician during the 1920s and the 1930s, who rose to fame when, having become disillusioned with mainstream politics, he turned to fascism. He was a Member of Parliament originally and later founded and led the British Union of Fascists. Now, some people may think, well, isn't that supportive of Italy with Mussolini and his idea of fascism. But fascism itself grew out of corporatism. And it was a nationalist ideology. And even though you had Mosley leading the British Union of Fascists, there were other groups in Britain that were also fascist. You had fascist or nationalists that were in Romania. You also had General Franco that had these sympathies there. So it wasn't a supportive of Italy or anything like that. When people ask about fascism today, I always say, well, the best way to describe a fascist is to look at the fasci, which is the bundle of sticks together. And when the bundle of sticks or the bundle of twigs are held together, they're strong enough to be an axe. You can put an axe head in there and you can then chop a log much, much bigger than the twigs. So the message that is saying is that you put a group together, all of the same particular type, and they're much stronger than they are as the individuals. And that actually goes all the way back to the fasci symbol, which was used in the Roman Empire. And you also see it today in the United States. I think it's in the Houses of Congress there. You've got two big symbols of fasci on either side. So it shows you that it was seen as an essential part of being European was the fasci. And it was not seen in a negative light right the way up until Mussolini used it as the symbol for his fascism. And at the end of the Second World War, I mean, they still have these fasci that are there on the Congress building in the United States. But I rather than going into all the details of what fascism is, that's the way that I would look at it. Look at the fasci. That's where the name for the term actually comes from. And you can understand that from that, what fascism is all about. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Yeah, as far as the fasci symbol is concerned, the bundle of sticks was meant to indicate people of a single kind bound together in such a way as to make them stronger. And the axe in the middle was intended to indicate a single leadership authority showing strong leadership. And that was the symbolism of that. But you're quite right. There are lots of buildings. If you go around many of the large buildings in London, but also in other major towns and cities around the UK and indeed around the world, then you will find that there will very often be fasci that will feature in the engravings that are made around the architraves of doors or in the various places architecturally. And it is because there was a reference back to the days of ancient Rome, where there was regarded as where the Roman Empire was regarded as an empire with strong leadership and a leadership that was capable of binding the people together to make them stronger effectively.
So it's beyond the dictionary definition that you would get of a fascist, and they would try and say that it goes back to Mussolini. Well, it doesn't. It goes back to the symbol, which is, you know, thousands of years old. Well, after military service during the First World War, Mosley was one of the youngest members of Parliament, representing Harrow from 1918 to 1924, first as a Conservative, then as an Independent, before going on to join the Labour Party. At the 1924 general election, he stood in Birmingham Ladywood against the future Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, coming within 100 votes of defeating him. And it was actually only 70 votes. I mean, it's a real tragedy that he didn't actually beat Neville Chamberlain. And I think, we didn't actually have Mosley as Prime Minister. And it's interesting here that we can see that he tried each one of the political parties, the Conservatives, Labour, and as an Independent. And then he formulated his ideology after being an insider in both of those. And I think that also shows us that back then, if you were a nationalist, you weren't necessarily associated with being the right wing or the left wing. It was beyond that. It's only today that it gets called far right. It wasn't a far right thing back then. And as we've talked about with some of our greatest Britons that were social nationalists, if you like, people that were certainly on the left, but they were also nationalists. I forget the name of the fellow who was a big English nationalist. We did a few episodes on him, Max, didn't we? And you had an essay that you'd written on his ideology, and he set up a load of magazines.
Robert Blatchford, you think?
That's it. Yes, Robert Blatchford. Because he was definitely on the left. And as we were talking about in the recent eugenics series as well, the people that were supportive of eugenics, they were on the right and they were on the left. So at this time, it wasn't seen as far right, wasn't seen as right wing extremism or anything like that. It was just purely wanting to do the best for your people. And that is the way that all nationalists still are today. Yet I think we get mischaracterized as being far right. And we can see here that, you know, he'd served in the First World War. When we get into the details of that, we will see that he was extremely brave and extremely courageous. Any comments you want to make on that, Max?
Also, he did join the Labour Party in 1926, between 26 and 31. And he became the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster during that period, which is kind of like minister without portfolio. So he was actually a cabinet minister in a Labour government at that time.
Wow. So a cabinet minister as well. Well, he returned to Parliament as Labour MP for Smethwick at a by-election in 1926 and served as Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster in the Labour government of 1929 to 1931. In 1928, he succeeded his father as the 6th Moseley Baronet, a title that had been in his family for more than a century. He was considered a potential Labour Prime Minister, but resigned because of discord with the government's unemployment policies. He chose not to defend his Smethwick constituency at the 1931 general election, instead unsuccessfully standing in Stoke-on-Trent. Moseley's new party, that's what it was called, became the British Union of Fascists in 1932. So it's a great shame, really, that he didn't stick with his Smethwick constituency, to be honest. And it was the government's unemployment policies. I think around about this time, if you look at the unemployment policy in Germany, they managed to get 6 million people back to work who were out of work. And Germany had been completely destroyed after the First World War, and they had to pay back all these debts. We all know about what happened with the Versailles Treaty. And you've got Oswald Mosley, who can see what's happening in Germany. And then here in Britain, you've still got the same mentality is going on. And we're in the middle of a depression. And we've got people walking all the way from Wales to London looking for work. And he can see that the Labour Party are not doing what they should be doing. Max, you want to say something there?
I was just going to say there was the Jarrow March as well during the 1930s that was against poverty, where people walked all the way from Tyneside down to London as well.
That may have even been the one that I'm thinking of. I just remember being told about this long march that people went on, and Mosley was disillusioned with the Labour Party's policy of dealing with unemployment. He had the same problem in America as well. We had the Great Depression. There was a big depression all around the world. That's why in Germany it was referred to as the economic miracle when everybody was put back to work. And of course that was by the NSDP. It was by the National Socialists there. So then you've got Mosley being interested in that and forming the British Union of Fascists here in Britain, because you can see, you know, the amazing way that Germany was brought back from the brink. Well, then we get to the Second World War, where Mosley was imprisoned without a trial and with no habeas corpus in May 1940 during the war, and the British Union of Fascists was banned. And remember that they were never taken to court, never going to trial, never given even an accusation of what it is that they had actually done. They were just put in prison for the duration of the war. Freed in 1943, Mosley founded the Union Movement, although soon moved abroad in 1951, spending most of the remainder of his life in Paris and 2 residences in Ireland. He stood for Parliament during the post-war era, but received little support. During this latter period, he was an advocate of pro-European integration and took part in founding the National Party of Europe. He's also known for the influence he had on the thinking of the founders of the Soil Association, a catalyst for the organic farming movement in Great Britain. And that was the first that I'd actually heard about that he had this link with organic farming. And also they leave out here Mosley's idea about economics, which apparently were a huge influence on a lot of people. Even John Major went back to Mosley's ideas about economics to try to solve one of the problems that we had in the 90s. So you would have thought that they would have mentioned this in the overview of his life, because this was very important. And obviously we will get to that. But yeah, I didn't know he was a founder of the Soil Association. Any thoughts on this, Max?
I didn't know he was a founder of the Soil Association. I know he had links with a lot of farming families, particularly in the Norfolk area. He did command a lot of support from people in, that were regarded as very respectable people and people that were very middle class and upper middle class. And so it's a great shame that that he wasn't able to convert the support that he had into enough political clout to prevent himself from being imprisoned during the Second World War, and in order to enable him to prevent us from going to war. Because one of the things as well was that he was anti-war. He didn't want to have a war with Germany. He didn't believe it was in Britain's interest to get involved in a war with Germany, and that was one of the reasons why he antagonized the establishment at that time.
Yeah, and it wasn't just him that was against the war either, was it? It was a lot of the people that actually fought in the First World War certainly didn't want to go back to war with Germany. There was a big movement to try and prevent the Second World War. And also this bit where he was supporting of organic farming, again, that was something that was involved with nationalism. You know, when you have the slogan blood and soil. So it was only natural that you would also not just being concerned about your own ethnic group, but you're also going to be concerned about the environment that your ethnic group is within. And we all love our country, all love the beauty that we have here within Britain of the countryside, and we want to preserve that. And instead of having a Green Party that is supportive of nationalism, we have a Green Party that is supposed to be concerned about the environment, but it's one of the biggest cheerleaders for mass immigration into Britain, and it doesn't appear to see any difference between the ethnicities at all. It's one of the ways that you can see that the Green Party, they're hypocrites, basically, because if you have white people, Europeans, they're concerned about the number of people that we have. Well, Europeans are not producing enough to replace ourselves. If you look at Europeans and you look at our farming practices, we have this organic farming, we take care of the environment. And then if you look at other people, say perhaps look at the Chinese, you look at how industrious they are, look at what they've actually done to China and the pollution in the Yangtze River, and they've killed off various species of dolphins and sea cow that they have over there. And the British people are very concerned about that. And as nationalists, we're very concerned about our environment. And I think the Green Party are complete hypocrites as far as that is concerned. And it's just a communist front, don't you think, Max?
Oh, I think certainly the Green Party is very woke and very left wing, and certainly not something that we should subscribe to at all these days. And you're quite right in what you're saying, that the environmental movement had lots of roots going into nationalism and fascism during the middle to early part of the last century. One of the things that just springs to mind that Mosley was involved in, and that I think the British Union of Fascists was involved in, was campaigning against the Church of England's imposition of tithes on property that they own. Sometimes if you buy a house, even nowadays, you'll buy a house and you'll find that there will be written into the deeds of the house a requirement for the homeowner to pay a tithe to the local church. So if you buy a house that's near a church, particularly in a rural area, you might find that you're required to pay a tithe to the church. Now, sometimes the churches enforce it, sometimes the churches don't enforce it. But the point is that during the early part of the last century, there were large swathes of land, particularly in the Norfolk area. And this is why Mosley gained a bit of an association with a number of families in the Norfolk area, where the landowners were similarly required to pay a tithe to the church. And of course, if you've got quite a few acres of land, then the tithe actually mounts up to quite a considerable amount of money. And that then created a situation where lots of small farmers couldn't afford to manage their farms profitably, because the tithe was effectively taking all of the profit out of the work that they were doing and more besides. And they struggled to make ends meet. And so one of the things that the British Union of Fascists did during that time was to campaign against the imposition of the tithe in this way.
I think there was concern for animals as well, particularly if you look at the, again, if you look at the NSDP in Germany, they were the first to bring in laws against vivisection and to protect the animals. And I can recall seeing a piece of propaganda which had all the animals standing up and applauding. And then there was a picture of Hermann Göring there. I think he had an influence on this. And that would have been similar for these other nationalist movements. They showed concern for the farmers. They showed concern for the environment. And they also showed concern for the animals there. And then when we see today, you can contrast this. I saw an article the other day about the National Trust, and they're destroying farms. They've been given farmland, and they're wanting to turn it back over to rewild it. Farms where, set for centuries, people have worked doing up the dry stone walling and making it so that it's fit for livestock and fit for arable farming, and so that you have a system of providing for everything, growing enough grass so that you can feed the animals in the winter and all that sort of thing. And then you've got the National Trust that are getting rid of it. And then in Holland, you've got this big drive to get rid of all the farming there because they say that it's producing too much carbon dioxide. So they're trying to destroy a certain amount of farms in Holland. And that's probably going to come this way as well. And you just know that the Green Party are going to support this. And they're going to say, oh, yes, well, we need to do this because of climate change, because of the carbon dioxide. We need to have less farmers. Whereas, if you contrast that back with these movements back then, Oswald Mosley's movement and the nationalist movements around Europe, they were very much concerned about farmers and caring about the farmers. And you can see here that he was one of the early founders of the Soil Association and the organic farming movement in Britain. And when you think of organic farmers today, you probably think of hippies. You probably don't think of nationalists at all. But you should think of nationalists, and we should be concerned about the environment, just not in the ways that we're being told today. Because, of course, the whole climate change thing is just a front to get all the governments working together underneath one large government. It's just communism in another guise. If they were genuinely concerned about the environment, they would be concerned about all these microplastics. They'd be concerned about this bisphenol A. They'd be concerned about the effect on our hormones from these hormone-altering plastics that are out there and all these different chemicals, all this estrogen that's in the environment. And we don't hear any of them talking about that. Instead, we hear them all supporting the agenda of diversity and climate change. And something as nationalists that I think we should capitalise on and talk about more about our concern for the environment. We need to get rid of this image that people have of us of hating other people. We don't. We love our own people. We want everybody to love their own people. And we're concerned about our environment. The environment that we have was built by our ancestors going back thousands of years. If you look at Britain, you see all those beautiful hedgerows, all those patchwork of those green fields, and it all looks very, very natural. But originally it was all woodland. And our ancestors cut down the woodland, and we built these farms, and we built these enclosures, and we built the land up the way that it is today. It was our ancestors that built all that. And it's not that by accident we happen to be born in this country and that's why it's ours. It's our country because it was our ancestors that shaped it. And that's why it looks so beautiful to us. You know, you often hear of these different ethnic groups, and they say, well, I don't feel welcome when I go into the country because there aren't so many of my sort of people in the country. Well, you wouldn't expect them to find the countryside as beautiful as the indigenous British do, because it's the indigenous British people's ancestors that shaped the countryside the way that it is, and they shaped it conforming to our beauty standards. Nobody is going to find the British countryside as beautiful as an indigenous Britain. And we are the ones that are really showing the concern for this. Of course, the government want to build up the green belt. They want to concrete over everything in order to build houses for the new people that are coming. And I should imagine you've also got the Green Party that are supporting that as well. But when you go back to this period, nationalist politics, as I say, it wasn't left, it wasn't right. It was just about doing what was best for the people and wanting the government to do what is best for the people. And that's when Mosley got disillusioned with the government, because he could see that they were not doing what is best for the people. And that's why he started off his new movement. And we'll get more into that next week. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Max, or shall we pause here?
No, I think this is a good place to pause, yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.